Ever since last month, when the world was stunned by Pope Benedict XVI's resignation and today's election of a new pope, religion's been on the minds of many. And that includes Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and he joins us now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Cindy.
Well, it's with this backdrop and then one a little closer to home that you recently wrote about religion and Michigan's lawmakers. And Bill Ballinger, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, recently surveyed how many members of the legislature are members of specific religious denominations. What interested you so much about this survey?
Well, I thought it was sort of interesting in that the survey found that the legislature pretty closely mirrors the religious makeup of Michigan as a whole. If anything, Episcopalians, who've been in decline for a long time, may be a little underrepresented. There are only three of them out of 110 legislators. Of course, that's not too different, although they were always the sort of the ruling class religion in America. When Congress started, most of the founding fathers were Episcopalians or Anglicans, and now what's amusing to me is that there are only three of them. Two of them are in the Senate. One of them is the one of the most conservative women in the Senate. The other is one of the most liberal women.
That's right. But they're all women, aren't they?
They certainly are. All three Episcopalians are women. And, of course, women are an increasing number. But as in the general population, Catholics are the largest group. Baptists have somewhat declined. United Methodists were the second largest denomination. But the interesting thing politically is when you put together the Catholics, whose church is officially sort of anti-abortion, and some of the more conservative Protestant denominations, you see why you have a legislature that is more actively anti-abortion, or as they say, pro-life, than the population as a whole.
You also thought it was interesting, a lot of them really didn't want to be pinned down, did they?
Yeah, I think that might be the most amusing part, that some of them didn't want to say a specific religion, not because they were ashamed of it, but because when they're home campaigning, they go to as many churches as possible on Sunday and like to give the impression the various denominations that they're one of them. But Ballinger is tenacious and managed to eventually pin everybody down as to what denomination they primarily were a member of. There was one lone agnostic who, as you might expect, was from Ann Arbor, and nobody openly said they were an atheist. There was one Muslim, only one Mormon, which might be a bit surprising, and then everybody else was sort of scattered among about as many denominations as you can think of, mainly Protestant.
Now, you did write in your column that when you were growing up, and here's your quote, enlightened people thought that religion had no place in politics, and this was sort of settled when the first Roman Catholic president, John Kennedy, was elected. But as you point out, it really does matter in a different way. Let's get into more about this abortion issue and the power of the Right to Life lobby.
Well, they have a tremendous amount of power, and you're absolutely right. I think it's not that religion matters so much. I think there are some people who still believe that Muslim Americans can't be truly good Americans, but certainly there's not the prejudice. We thought when Kennedy was elected in 1960, it was the first time a Roman Catholic had managed to become elected, and we thought we had sort of broken through a prejudice barrier. And while it was lesser noted, when Al Gore nominated a vice presidential candidate who was an Orthodox Jew, there didn't seem to be any negative reaction. In fact, Gore's almost winning Florida was in part attributed to a huge turnout of the Jewish vote in Florida because they were proud of Lieberman being on the ticket. But the thing that is a divide is very interesting to speculate, at least for me, whether John F. Kennedy could have been elected today. There was no abortion issue in 1960. There wasn't any until Roe versus Wade in 1973. And Catholics are now quite fiercely divided. A lot of them don't follow the teachings of their church or don't hold with it. And some of them do, so that you have phenomena where in 2004, in a very close presidential election, John Kerry, another Roman Catholic nominated for president, not only lost, he lost the Catholic vote. Which, of course, John F. Kennedy won the Catholic vote by overwhelming 3-1 margin. So this issue has really impacted American politics, and to the extent that it's a religious issue, I guess you could say it is religion and politics.
Now, there's been a lot of talk, Jack, among political pundits, both nationally and statewide, that Republicans might be shooting themselves in the foot, in a sense, doing themselves a disservice, focusing too much on controversial social issues. Let's just think of the Republican males who've gotten themselves in terrible hot water as of late with their comments on rape and abortion, rather than focusing on economic issues. In your opinion, how much is religion behind this?
Well, it's not religion in the sense that the priest is telling them from the pulpit who to vote for, but if they have strong opinions that abortion is never okay Those are usually opinions motivated by religion. And so that sometimes not only gets in the way of practical politics, but of electability. You know, it's not just me saying this. Some Republicans are saying it. Brooks Patterson, who always was seen as a conservative Republican, the longtime head of Republican politics in Oakland County, is now the Oakland County executive, has been cautioning his people to back off of this, forget about the social issues. He says, when we start talking about economic issues, we win. When we talk about social issues, we lose. And that certainly has been the case in affluent places like Oakland County, where you have cities like Birmingham and Bloomfield Hills, where the Democrats, especially in national and statewide races, do much better now because there are a lot of affluent, working Republican women who find their economic stands just fine but can't swallow the party's stand on social issues.
Yeah, so that there really could be something to that about shooting themselves in the foot.
Of course, it's helped the Republicans in other places, in some, you know, conservative Baptist areas in the South, and in some cases in Michigan, Republicans do better than they used to. But on balance, the consensus is that the more Republicans rely on social issues, the less likely they are to win national elections.
Jack, overall, do you think religion is complicating politics in Michigan?
I think social issues are complicating politics in Michigan. I think that you know, as far as religion specifically, as the percentage of Muslims who become citizens and vote continues to grow, this may be a factor, but we've often don't realize that many Muslims are not yet citizens, while the Muslim population is increasing, and even some of those who are citizens don't vote. In the city of Dearborn, where Muslims are now a very significant presence, I think they have only one city council person. I'm not quite sure of that, but that was the case for a long time. And when a Muslim candidate ran for mayor a few years ago, they did very, very poorly. So this is a case, I think, the closest we have to actually a religious difference. It's more a social issue difference, and it's more a case where sort of what we might call fundamentalist religions, fundamentalist Protestants, and traditional Catholic hierarchy are sort of making common cause against more liberal Protestant denominations, and as all the polls show us, sort of conventional mainline, maybe socially liberal Protestant denominations are losing. They're losing members, have been losing members for 40 or 50 years, and whereas the sort of more conservative denominations, these huge sort of evangelical churches, some of which have thousands of members, have been growing.
Where do you think things go from here, Jack, in terms of politicians talking about religion? Of course, there was so much attention paid to the fact that Mitt Romney was Mormon in the presidential race, and really that didn't affect it at all. A lot about nothing. Do you think there will be more or less in terms of politicians being upfront about religion?
I think that what may happen is that, first of all, people will be watching the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage in California, although a lot of people, including me, are sort of baffled that the public has changed so rapidly on this particular issue. While there hasn't been a lot of movement on abortion, people have rapidly come to accept sort of gay rights, even gay marriage, and you'll probably have a situation where you'll have a number of states where it's legal and a number of states where it's not. I think the Republican Party has to decide whether they want to keep emphasizing and talking about this, and I think if Republicans continue to lose presidential elections, eventually they'll come to a point sort of like they did with Social Security and some of the New Deal reforms, where they'll say, well, it's okay if we're against this personally, but we're not going to emphasize this, we're not going to talk about this anymore in our campaign. Certainly, I think that Republicans are going to put huge pressure on all their candidates, not to mention the term rape, in any further campaign, unless to just say they're against it. It's very clear that Republicans lost two U.S. Senate seats that they were certain to win because of their candidates making way outside the mainstream statements about rape and about whether women who are raped could conceive. And, you know, there's a huge pressure to kind of avoid these issues. And we may eventually see this on the abortion issue.
Perhaps fewer cringe moments.
Well, the politicians will give us cringe moments of one kind or another. The only question is, what kind will there be?
Jack, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure.
Jack Lesenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn now to the subject of cybersecurity. Recent reports focused on the Chinese military as being the source of cyber attacks on American corporations and some government agencies. Last week, the White House demanded that the Chinese government stop the widespread theft of data from American computer networks and agree to what's called acceptable norms of behavior in cyberspace. It was a fairly stern scolding. All that ties in with a recent piece in Crane's Detroit Business, digging into what's being done in Michigan to prevent or fight back against cyber attacks. Writer Chris Gouts joins us now from Lansing. Welcome back to Stateside, Chris.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
We know that both North Carolina or South Carolina and Utah have been hacked. What happened in those cases?
Those were cases where in South Carolina, it was the numbers were particularly staggering. Computer hackers were able to gain access to about 3.6 million Social Security numbers. A lot of those were encrypted, but there were, I believe, maybe 10 to 20,000 of those that were not. So there was a real concern that you could pair names and Social Security numbers and obviously then do a lot of damage when it comes to, you know, ID theft. And then in Utah, I believe they were hackers from some European country where they were able to get into the files of about 800,000 Medicaid recipients and then also some Social Security numbers as well. So it's becoming more of a widespread problem that various states are starting to see.
And you say Michigan so far hasn't been hacked, but I couldn't believe it. You wrote that we're weathering about 187,000 cyber attacks every day.
Every day, yeah. And a lot of those can be sort of harmless attacks, so to speak. I mean, some of them could be, you know, an employee maybe just opening up an email from a Nigerian prince and maybe clicking a link. And the state actually, as part of their, as part of Governor Snyder's efforts, has a cybersecurity range online on the state's website that encourages schools and businesses and just regular people to go on there. And then they've got internet safety tips that you can learn. But yeah, there haven't been any major attacks, but there have been attempts where things have happened to the state site. Last August, there was an incident where there was a denial of service attack or a DOS. And it happened on the state's website on a Sunday evening, I think around 8 o'clock, where the site's the state's website was completely down for about an hour. And those sites and those type of attacks are more, they're just trying to cause a problem. There's not really, most denial of service attacks aren't really aimed at any sort of financial gain in the long term. It's more of just trying to be a sort of more of a nuisance attack.
So mischief.
Yeah, and a lot of banks are now faced with that. You know, if somebody has the wherewithal and the know-how to do it, and they have an issue with the bank, whether it's a local issue or they have some, it's a mega bank that they just despise, they can sort of flood the servers, and it causes, you know, basically your site to crash, and that's what a denial of service attack is. And so the states had those, and they've had other smaller incidents, but nothing that rose to the level where we've actually lost information, so that they know of.
We're talking with writer Chris Gouts, who's with Crane's Detroit Business and covers Lansing for Crane's, and looking at what is being done to protect Michigan businesses and government against cyber attacks. And Chris, you write about something called spear phishing, the P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, a spear phishing attempt against state employees. What is that, and how did that play out?
Yeah, spear phishing is something that I just sort of learn about in doing the story. And it's where you'll get an email that the state experiences a few weeks ago where they actually had an intrusion, but it didn't end up being any sort of security breach. But an email went out to about 2,000 state employees that it was one of those emails that says, hey, your email is all full, your server's full. If you send us your information, your login and password, we can clean that up for you and get you back to where you can start sending out and receiving emails again. And it looked very official. I was told that I think it had, you know, state letterhead. It looked very legit, but it was not. And 142 people, state employees, sent in that login information. But the state security team was right on top of it. They monitored the stuff 24/7, and they were able to cut it off and stop it. But this is sort of a new way in which people that are doing cyber attacks when you do a spearfishing attack like this, one thing it does is it sort of gets you a foothold into that network that you're trying to log into. Hmm. And you can then, once you get a foothold, you can then go and do other attacks because now you're into the system. You have a login into that system.
Who do we think is doing this? Who's sending these hacking attempts?
You know, it's really unclear. It could just be people that are just trying to make, you know, money. Obviously, all of these attacks, you know, the ultimate goal is to make money, whether or not they're selling the information or they're trying to get a foothold into the state system so that they could then try to hack into the state treasury department. That's really what the goal is. But there's been no real, you know, clear definition. Is this from China? Is it from, you know, Indiana? That's really sort of unclear, I think, at this point.
One thing you write about, Chris Gouts, is there's a big effort that's been going on really for the past couple of years, a joint effort between the state and business. Tell us who's involved, what companies and state agencies, and what are they doing?
Yeah, I thought this was some of the more interesting piece, obviously, to me, but also to obviously our readership at Cranes, was that that the state is not going this alone. And from what I've been able to tell from looking at other states and how they're doing it across the nation, a lot of states are doing this on a more insular basis, that they're just trying to protect their own system, whereas the state of Michigan has been very proactive for the last year or so in involving the private sector. So you've got, so that they said, you know, we need to make sure that not only our system is secure, but if there was ever a large internet attack, cyber attack, we need to make sure that our critical infrastructure, our utilities, our water, our broadband system, so there's internet, so there's phone service, you know, 80% of that is owned by the private sector. So if there was a major attack, you know, the state's computer system might be fine, but nobody might be able to get into it because the internet's down or the phone lines are down. So
yeah.
DTE Energy, CMS Energy, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Spectrum Health, Plant Moran, and even some manufacturers, you know, Borg Warner and Penske are all part of this group. And they've come up with this plan, a cyber disruption response plan. They're fine-tuning this plan, and then they're going to be releasing this plan to the public later this spring. So we'll see sort of the fruits of what they've been working on for the last year.
You know, it's funny. It just kind of gives me echoes of growing up in the 60s when we would have our air raid drills and all get under our desks. But the idea was we were preparing for, you know, some kind of possible calamity. Better be prepared, I guess.
Yeah, it is better to be prepared. And Michigan is really recognized nationally as somebody who is really a national leader in this, and other states are starting to model themselves after what Michigan is doing, especially as it relates to involving the private sector. That's something sort of new that Michigan is really a leader on. And so Mr. Lorman, the chief security officer of the state, that speaks at a lot of conferences. He was just recently at the National Governors Association where they had a special hearing just on cybersecurity, where he was one of the few that was able to speak about sort of what Michigan is doing and is very well respected in the field.
Chris, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Chris Gouts is the Capital Reporter for Cranes Detroit Business. St. Patrick's Day is coming up this Sunday, and for many people, whether Irish or not, the holiday brings a chance to hear musicians playing toe-tapping jigs, reels, hornpipes, and other old Celtic tunes at clubs and pubs all over Michigan. One of those musicians is Asher Perkins of Oakland County. At age 23, Asher has been playing button, accordion, and concertina largely as part of his family's acclaimed Celtic music band, Finvarra's Wren. Making music like this has been a part of Asher's life for the past 17 years. But even as he's carved out a national reputation in traditional Irish music, Asher Perkins has been making a name for himself in a totally different area, in techno music, with his EP Hammers on Trees and a second CD called Evasion. Asher Perkins joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Michigan Radio and to Stateside, Asher.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the music of the season, the traditional Irish music. Certainly, it had to have been in your blood even before you were born with parents who are renowned in the field. But what drew you to button accordion?
You know, I started out, obviously, just watching my dad play music as a kid. And I started out learning to play the tin whistle, which is a really simple traditional Irish instrument. And after doing that for a couple of years, I was seven, and I walked into a toy store. And they happened to have a toy button accordion with 7 buttons on it. And it was all made of plastic. I still have it at home, and it's close to destroyed. But so I saw this thing, and I asked my parents. I was like, can I please get this accordion? And they actually said no.
They said no.
They said no. Why don't you learn to play something nice or like pleasant, you know?
Something like the fiddle or pipes or something.
So I didn't end up with it that day, but I just could not forget about it. And I just begged them and begged them and begged them for it. And I eventually got it on Christmas. So.
And from there?
From there, I learned to play a few Christmas carols and eventually started learning to play traditional Irish tunes and just couldn't put it down, and I still can't put it down. So,
what is it about that? Can you put it into words about what it is you get when you play?
Now that I look back on it, I feel like a lot of it may have to do with, even as a little kid, I was totally obsessed with electronics. And I don't know if it was to me that the accordion seemed just enough mechanical or, it's not electronic, but it kind of has that same element to it. Like you're pushing buttons, you're moving things around. It's very mechanical. And that definitely always grabbed my interest. And then, after I started playing it and listening to the music and everything more, I just really fell in love with the tone of it as well. So,
and it just
all around, I just love the instrument.
And you learned quickly, and you learned a lot. And am I correct that you actually were on stage with the Chieftains here in Ann Arbor at what
That's
age?
Right. I think I was 10 years old.
There with like the finest traditional Irish music band in the world. It didn't faze you at all?
It didn't faze me, but it fazed my entire family. When I remember, I'll never forget this, we went out to Fridays to eat just before the gig, and I just remember my mom especially was just freaking out, and I was fine. I didn't think anything of it.
I'm going to Hill Auditorium. I'm playing with the Chieftains.
Yeah.
I know that the Southeast Michigan area really has had some tremendously strong Irish musicians who've actually, I know there were some young musicians a few years ago who went over to Ireland and captured a title at the World Competition. Why is that? Why is it so strong in Southeast Michigan? Or is it really strong throughout Michigan?
You know, there were a few key people that definitely helped educate a lot of younger musicians like myself. Namely, Terrence McKinney was definitely really important in my learning experience. He plays the Uilleann pipes, which is an Irish version of the bagpipes.
And anyone who heard Titanic heard the Uilleann pipes.
That's right.
And Braveheart for that soundtrack. Okay, yeah.
So I would imagine that, because of him and also because of Al Purcell, who was also a great Uilleann piper in the area, they both were highly responsible for educating people. And Mick Gavin as well. He's a great fiddle player.
From County Clare.
Yep,
and
that's right.
Lives in Redford. So it takes, as you say, it's passed down from the elders on
right.
to. And then what about if someone's listening now and they think, I've got a kid who seems drawn to the fiddle or whatever. How would someone go about trying to learn?
There's a great organization here I believe it's based in Ann Arbor. And it's called the Detroit Irish Music Association. And that's actually run in part by Terrence. He's really highly involved in that, as well as many other great musicians. Mick is there a lot of the time, and his son, Michael Gavin, who is also an incredible banjo player and fiddler. But yeah, that's a great organization. You can take lessons from them. You can, they put on concerts, all sorts of stuff. So that's the place.
All right, we're going to take a break and have you give us a sample now of your button accordion skills.
Let's see.
There is such a difference between the kind of music you just played for us on the button accordion and the techno that you have started to produce. So where did that come from?
Well, it's kind of funny because as a kid, I was so incredibly enthralled with accordion and Irish music and folk music and all the stuff that my family listened to that I never stopped to think that there were thousands, if not millions, of other styles of music in the world. And I swear it was just one day suddenly I was like, oh, there's all this other stuff. So I just totally broke out of my shell and started listening first to like punk rock and stuff and started going to shows and losing my shoes and all that kind of stuff. And eventually a friend of mine who just lived down the road happened on a techno CD, and we started listening to it, and he ended up not liking it at all, and I ended up loving it. So a couple of years after that, I started going to the Detroit Electronic Music Festival and was just really blown away by everything I experienced there, just the energy of the crowds and the performers themselves, and also the fact that everything, in most cases, was being controlled by just one guy. Mm-hmm. So it was like this massive sounding music with tons of bass and crazy audio effects and just, you know, really incredible stuff. And you would look up there and it's not a whole band, you know, you don't have to work with all these other people. It's just one guy who has an idea for what it should sound like and he stands there and plays it.
How would you describe the feeling of creating that compared to with the feeling of sitting with a bunch of Irish musicians playing jigs and reels?
It's almost completely opposite to me. You know, the feeling when I'm playing music with my friends and it's all acoustic and everything, it's very carefree. And, you know, I'll be sitting there and I'm playing a set of reels and I'm thinking about what I'm going to make for dinner later that night, you know. And it's really therapeutic and really just fun and relaxing. But, and that's not to say that techno isn't fun and relaxing, but it's also very analytical and sometimes mathematical. So it's almost, I don't know, it really stimulates the more logical parts of my brain. And when I'm producing music, everything kind of has to be, at least, you know, for my method, it kind of has to be planned out somewhat in advance. So it kind of gets rid of, you know, the carefree environment of just playing and open experimentation and replaces it with careful construction and very exact frequencies and drum patterns and everything like that. You know, I'll replay the same part of my track a million times and tweak one little thing and then move on, you know.
And is there a chance, a possibility of marrying the two and coming up with your own style?
There was one show that I did, and there's a very select few people who might be listening who will know about this. Hopefully not.
Obviously, it didn't go well.
There was one show that my dad and I decided to do really last minute where we played in a pub and didn't really advertise it at all. And we just decided we were going to do a live Irish techno experience. So he was singing, and he was singing traditional Irish songs and playing whistle and guitar and all this stuff. And I was recording loops and samples of what he was doing and then playing them back in combination with, like, drum loops and synthesizers and effects. And then sometimes I would sequence a bunch of stuff, and then I would play the accordion over it all. And it was tremendous amounts of fun, but I don't know if I would ever want to go listen to it. You know, I'm really glad we didn't record it or anything like that. So I'm not sure that's likely to happen in the near future, but you never know.
If you had to pick one or the other, techno or traditional Irish, would you be able to pick one?
I really don't think I could at this point. You know, if you had asked me a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago or so, it definitely would have been Irish music just because I grew up with it. But at this point, they're both such enormous parts of my life, I don't think I could leave either one behind.
Asher Perkins, his family's band Finvar's Wren, plays a regular schedule of dates. We have put a link to their website up at michiganradio.org, and we put a link to his techno music, again, on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. I know you've got an EP coming out in April called The Heart Race.
That's right.
So techno continuing, but we're not letting down the Irish as well. Thanks, Asher, very much for joining us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, 2012 was, to put it mildly, a terrible year for Michigan farmers. That heat wave last March, followed by April frost, basically wiped out most of the state's apple, cherry, and other fruit crops. And then came the summer with high temps and little rain. That hurt corn, soybean, and other important crops. So what might be ahead for Michigan farmers in 2013? Well, there are the weather worries, and there's a potential shortage of migrant workers. And since much of Michigan agriculture depends on seasonal or migrant workers to get those crops harvested, a shortage is not welcome news to Michigan farmers. Joining us is Craig Anderson. He manages the Agricultural Labor and Safety Services Program for the Michigan Farm Bureau, and he is also a longtime family farmer. Welcome, Craig.
Glad to be here.
And joining us from Bear Lake, where I think we all wish we were right now because that sounds really pretty, is David Smeltzer. David's the owner of West Wind Orchards. And thanks for joining us today, David.
Well, thank you. My father is also in partnership with us up here, too. My father, Clinton, who is 89 years old, is still while not active on every day, is still an active participant in the activity here. So,
and that is certainly something that we're sensing is when we are talking about our Michigan farms, we are talking about family histories and a real sense of being rooted to your farm. I was getting that in speaking with Craig. I can certainly hear that with you too, David, and knowing that your 89-year-old father is still part of the operation. Craig, I want to start with you. If you could spell out for us to help us understand just how last year's bad weather and failed crops could result in a shortage of migrant labor this year.
The agricultural system across the country takes a look at the need for seasonal labor. And as that need has progressed, it starts in the South. Florida and Texas are actively growing right now. It'll move up through the Georgias and the Carolinas, through Arkansas and up through southern Illinois, and ultimately finish for most folks up here in Michigan. Our production season really starts with asparagus coming up here in about a month, and then it ends for the vast majority of the migratory laborers at the end of apple harvest, really hopefully mid-October to the end of October. One of the challenges is that for the worker to really have a significant income throughout the course of the year, they need to be working throughout the course of the year rather than just the 3 months that we have generally opportunities for them here in Michigan. So most of those workers did, in fact, find work in other areas. Now, that's the traditional model. Now we overlay a number of issues in regards to immigration, primarily in the southern states, again, that have passed state-based immigration laws.
Okay.
Now, in many cases, we have families that have been with us for a long period of time. In my home operation, we had families who started right after World War II and followed us through multiple generations, not only of our family, but also of the workers' family through the 70s. And my mom, who is 90, still converses with many of those. And so to be able to have the workforce when we need them, it's very difficult. In Michigan, we compete for the local worker, if you will, with the folks who would work at, for example, the Traverse City Cherry Festival. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens during the Cherry Festival? Hopefully we're harvesting cherries. And so for many people, would you rather work on a beach, for example, picking up the beer cans, or would you rather work on the farm for that same period of time? And so we have a difficult time in recruiting, in many cases, the local workforce that would fill, because that's when everyone is looking for a workforce.
Okay. So what happened with respect to hiring decisions that had to be made last year and cuts because of the bad crops, and how is that impacting whether people are going to be back in Michigan to work this year?
Well, for many in the fruit industry, we simply had no crop. We had a limited two, three areas that did harvest a portion of the crop. Now, the challenge is that many of the workers who do come to Michigan work in multiple crops. And so that also impacted those vegetable crops, for example, that were planted after the freeze. It hurt the packing structures as well. And so you had a cascade of a belief that we simply did not have any work here in Michigan. Well, we did. So we had shortages of workers even last year because of the knowledge that the core crop, the base crop, the apple production, was not going to have the need for the workers that we traditionally have.
So they aren't coming back this year, or Michigan's kind of off their list this year?
We don't know because our contact for many of them has really a 2011 flavor to it. And when we try and make the contacts, again, this is a workforce that moves. They're transient.
Mm.
And to be able to contact them, many of the cell phone numbers that we had are no longer the correct number.
Okay.
Many of the addresses that we have are no longer the correct address. So we're doing everything we can as an industry to contact those workers who we have had for many years to try and make sure if, in fact, they are coming back. But most operations with that core group also have peak need type of labor forces, and those generally were showing up at the door or going through the traditional market structure where one worker would tell another worker who would tell another that there's a farm in Pierport that there's a job at.
And let me ask you, David Smeltzer, from the perspective of your operation at West Wind Orchards, in a normal year, in a good year, let's skip everything that happened last year, you would normally use how many workers to do what?
18 to 20 people to harvest the apple crop.
All right. And so with everything that happened weather-wise last year, what happened?
Our labor force was 9. And we made that determination based on what we did. As Craig alluded to, there were pockets of fruit. Our operation here is 125 acres of apples. And of that 125 acres of apples, the fruit was probably concentrated on less than 30. Maybe even 25 at that point, where there was enough fruit to actually warrant going in the orchard to harvest. Based on that and some historical data, working with a couple of fellows that have been on the farm for years, we just went around and made a base guess. Let's pick a number. Let's say 10. No, I think 9. And we based that on fruit size and different things, movement of people, how we would operate through the orchards, the days that would take, factoring in rain, weekends, what we might do, and so in the time frame that it would take. Because the crop was spotty. It wasn't. We had virtually no front-end fruit, which was McIntosh, Empires, and Galas. Primarily the fruit was later in the year, Red Delicious, Romes, Eider Reds. We did have an early ginger gold crop, but we functioned with what it would take to pick, how long it would take to pick, and get it picked properly as the fruit did mature.
So you had to make cuts. And what are you looking ahead to? What are your worries, if I may, looking ahead into 2013?
Well, the labor force is the critical component. Since the beginning of time, apples have been picked with hands, and hands are attached to people. And so it still requires that. There are some adaptations in the industry by using machines, but primarily they're just moving platforms that still require people to harvest the fruit. So we still need the labor. As Craig alluded to, there's always competition for the labor. And even the generational component of this is interesting because, similar to what Craig was talking about, we've worked with a family of Hispanic labor since the early 70s. The young men, the family, are running the business now, and they are contract labor people. They came to my father in 1971, 72, and said, we can provide you with a labor force. Here it is 2013, and we're still working with the same group of people. And watching them grow up and watching the kids grow up and the evolution of the workforce moves itself into other things. For example, the crew leader's son, one of them is a professional photographer. One of his daughters is an attorney. And so the traditional as it were, harvest force that would just migrate through the country, they have opportunities have prevailed to them where they can now do other things. And Javier, who used to pick apples here, is now a professional photographer in Florida. His brother runs a chain of Mexican food outlets down there. And like I said, one of the other daughters is now an attorney and is raising her family in Holland, Michigan. So there is this other things that draw the labor force away. Landscape industry is one of the big ones.
Okay, yeah.
So they just find other things to do. So we have to accommodate that by offering some other things to just keep people in the labor force.
What kinds of things can you offer? What are you trying to do to get your workers?
Primarily, it's a two to three month thing here through the summer. People come here, asparagus will start, we have strawberries, we move into cherries. But the driving force is apples, and it is what requires the largest number of people. So we offer a wage that will work when otherwise we don't. We usually pay by the box rate, and which provides them with their wage. But we also have our labor camp. It's a seasonally licensed camp. We have running water. We have shower facilities. There's toilets. There's laundry facilities there, providing an environment for them that is accommodating to them. It's friendly. They come every year. They know what to expect when they come to our farm. And so those things will, you know, at least provide an incentive for them to want to come back.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And we're talking about the possible shortage of seasonal labor workers to come onto Michigan farms and do crucial, crucial work and looking ahead to what the year might bring. As I speak with David Smeltzer, who's the owner of West Wind Orchards in Bear Lake. And here in the studio, we have Craig Anderson, who's with the Michigan Farm Bureau. And I'd like to get the thoughts of both of you on this question. As I'm hearing you describe, David, you have families of migrant workers who are really going in directions and setting down roots and building new lives. So that's going to thin the ranks, if it will. Where do you go for new labor? And I guess with that, I'm wondering, with unemployment so high in Michigan's big cities, is there any merit of looking for workers in, say, Flint or Detroit, people who do need jobs?
That question always comes up. There's a high unemployment rate. We'll just hire people who are currently unemployed, and they can do the work.
Right.
Keep in mind that, and I've advocated this, and I've said this in for years, that the migratory labor force, which is primarily Hispanic, the migratory labor force is as professional as what they do as plumbers and attorneys, and as professional as what they do. All right. Vegetables require a certain skill set. Field labor requires a certain skill set. Harvesting apples requires a certain skill set. There's a mindset that we get up and we go to work in the morning. It might be cold, it might be damp, it might be wet. These folks come to work. Now, granted, we don't work in a pouring down rain or thunderstorms, but we will go back to work when that stops, but we will work in a cold, maybe somewhat uncomfortable climate that these people, because they come, it's what they've done, it's traditional, and they move through this work because it's what they do. Now, I've often said that I could not feed my family harvesting apples. I simply cannot do it. But they have a skill set that they can do, and they can do this work. And so we turn to the Hispanic population for that because it's just part of the culture, if I can be so bold as to say that. And so in order to provide incentives, we do other things to get the people to stay with us, and we nurture that family component. I have second-generation people that were kids. When I used to sit there with my father and go to the labor camp and discuss what we're going to do, sitting across the table looking at those kids that now I do business with.
Hmm.
And this is there. And since 1971, this same family and group of families have been coming to our farm. So we're doing something that is providing that opportunity for them. So those are the things we have to focus on. But to simply suggest that folks who are temporarily unemployed will come and do the work, it doesn't translate just directly. And so we haven't had success doing that, so we stick with our Hispanic help.
And Craig, your thoughts?
Well, many operations do, in fact, try to attract the local workforce and have varying degrees of success or failure. One of the biggest challenges is we are seasonal. As David indicated, we work outside, and we work in the conditions that the outside provides. We're in and around. We're dirty in many cases. We're hot. We're sweaty. We have multiple layers of clothes for those who are out pruning apples right now. And that's one of the significant challenges. You have a system, or we have a system here, that provides for a benefits package that allows people who are unemployed to obtain a benefits mm-hmm. package. Mm-hmm. Now, when we come in, we're asking them to say, okay, we have 3 weeks' worth of asparagus harvest. Will you end your benefits package to come to work for us and then go back and reapply and continue on in your benefits package until you're needed again in sweet cherries?
Yeah.
And then again do that in apples, and then again do that in Christmas trees. Many farms have tried to adapt to that, and they have put on crops that they hopefully are breaking even with but are providing a longer term mm-hmm. of employment. But for our high hand labor need crops, it's just simply very difficult to have someone who is currently unemployed from a job that was 40 hours a week in a building to come out and work on the farm.
So with that said, Where do you find new workers?
We are looking at nationally an adjustment in the immigration process. That's one of the challenges that we have faced for many, many decades, is where that stepping stone agricultural job worker is going to come from. Early on, we looked at the family members, the farm family members. Many of those, we have expanded our farms, so that group of labor just simply isn't there and available. We've looked at the high schools. That, too, has become difficult because we're competing in many cases about those summer jobs at the restaurants and the Dairy Queens, but also we're competing against the summer sports programs. So that causes a challenge there, too. We do have that skill set, and the schools have really moved away from training for jobs in areas such as agriculture and other technical areas because, again, this is technical. Yes, we have the hand labor, but we do have equipment operation activities. And if you look at what we used to consider somewhat of a menial type of activity, even sorting fruit, for example, now it requires tactile knowledge of the firmness or hardness of the fruit, the color activities that we look at, any type of stem puncture, any type of potential disease activities. So we need someone who knows a lot about the production of food. And that, too, is difficult with those that are unemployed at this point in time.
Craig Anderson manages the Agricultural Labor and Safety Services Program for the Michigan Farm Bureau, and David Smeltzer owns West Wind Orchards in Bear Lake. Thank you both so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.